And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And we do that on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at those times at richarddugan.com. The link is right there in the upper right-hand portion of the website, the homepage. Actually, every page of the website, you have a link to listen live during those times, as well as go to the archives, the podcasts. They're on SoundCloud. They're on iTunes. They're also at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. And there are, what is it, now 11? 11 pages of programs spanning 11 years. So there are a lot of interviews for you to listen to and a lot of information for you to gather. And we certainly hope that you will avail yourselves of that. We also give out and link to our guest's website. We'll be giving that information to you shortly. We certainly hope that you will go to our guest's website to continue your evolutionary process, if you will, of growing and learning and changing your life for the better, as well as helping others around you to do the same. That's what kind of what we're here. That's what we're all about here on this program, is helping us to find those choices and knowledge of those choices to help make our dreams come true, make our lives better, make the lives of the people around us better, if they are so inclined. And we certainly hope that you are an encouraging part of their lives, as we do try to be in your life. We also encourage you, if you would like to, we are certainly open to any support you would like to give us. We have a PayPal account set up for support for this broadcast at the on the homepage, as well as our missions page, which tells you about what we're doing here. In terms of, have you not listened to any of the interviews? Well, you can go to the missions page and you can read about what we're doing, why we're doing it, and so forth. And if you feel so inclined, if you're of like mind and you'd like to support the work we're doing, we're greatly appreciative of that. We'll take energetic support as well. So please avail yourselves of that as well. Today we're going to be going into basically looking at an area of our lives that we like to wallow in it, but we don't like to talk much about it. And there are some folks who don't have a problem with it from the standpoint of this solitary life. But there's a difference between that and being lonely. We're going to be talking about that from the standpoint of the anatomy of loneliness and how to find your way back to connection. We're going to be talking with the author of this book and many others. We are encouraging you to go to the website as well. We'll give that to you in a moment. Teal Schwann, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program today. This is going to be, I think, a very informative and hopefully uplifting program that people can connect with. And of course, that's one of the aspects of the anatomy of loneliness is connection. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So the first aspect of this, I mentioned at the outset of the program, there are some people who have no problem with the solitary life, which is far different than the concept, if you will, of loneliness. So let's define that term from your perspective. What is loneliness?
Well, the first thing I have to say is I've actually never met somebody that's okay with the solitary life. What it is that they prefer the solitary life over being in close connection with humans because they've experienced so much pain when they are in the close vicinity of other people. So that's important to know. So it's almost like, it's not like I choose this because I love it. It's I choose it because I prefer it to the pain of the other.
Mm.
The way that I look at loneliness is that you feel like you're in a void. Your internal world is not seen, and so it's actually a state of emotional starvation.
Hmm. I know that there are those who may prefer actually the company of animals over humans because
of pain.
Yeah. You yourself have experienced a great deal of pain in your early years. Can you talk to us about that and how that has been a catalyst for the work that you're doing?
Yeah, actually, I'm the perfect candidate for somebody who would throw people over for animals. In my childhood, the only real close connection that I got was with horses, because to be honest with you, you know, I was born into a family that didn't really understand me at all, and I felt totally alienated from them. I didn't feel like a sense of belonging. I didn't feel like I could be understood. And then besides my family, what I had was a culture of radical, you know, Mormons, basically LDS community, who completely pushed my family to the side of society and didn't want us to have anything to do with them or their children. And so there wasn't any connection with other children. And then what I ended up falling into was catching on the radar of a local person in the community that loosely knew my parents, who was a psychopath. And so for 13 years, he infiltrated my family as a kind of mentor for me. And my parents entrusted me over to him because they were like, well, we don't understand this kid or what to do with her, and she's miserable. So, you know, if somebody's coming in saying, I know what to do, we're going to sort of trust her to him, not knowing, of course, that behind their backs he was torturing me, sexually, emotionally, mentally, everything. So for 13 years, I was tortured, and I was terrified of people. People were nothing but pain to me, and yet I couldn't get rid of the need for that kind of intimacy. I just didn't know how to get it or whether it was possible. So I spent the majority of my life just feeling like I was living in a void, but more torturous than that, a void where all kinds of other people exist. Sort of like when you walk in a city, you're with thousands of other people on the street sometimes, but you're still feeling completely isolated. And, you know, I thought I was the only one. That was where this went. That's what loneliness does. Loneliness and pain convinces you that you're the only one that's in it. So when I escaped, I figured everybody else can connect. Everyone else is having these fabulous Christmas, you know, dinners and fabulous Thanksgiving gatherings, and they actually feel connected. And when I'm there, I just feel like I'm by myself in a room. But what blew my mind when I started into this work of, you know, really owning the fact that this is what I'm meant to do here as a, you know, spiritual luminary or as a revolutionary in terms of personal transformation, is everyone that I was meeting, regardless of what culture they belong to, regardless of what their family dynamic was, and where I was in the world, everybody reported this exact same sensation that I was describing. So I realized this was way bigger of an epidemic than just my own solitary life.
Now, and again, I'm kind of going backwards a little bit, but again, this doesn't have anything to do with those people, individuals, or even families who choose to be off the grid. They don't want anything to do with society, government, social structure, other than their own. They'll go up in the mountains somewhere and disappear because they want absolutely nothing to do. That's a whole nother area, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's totally different to what I'm describing.
All right. So when you started putting this work together, I noticed that at the pretty much the end of almost every chapter, there are you're also a poet, and you have poems at the end of each of these beautiful chapters. I have not been able to get into poetry. I remember in school, though, that, you know, we were required to memorize certain poems and recite them in front of the class, kind of thing, so that it showed that, A, we'd read the poem, and hopefully we'd gotten the meaning from it. And there are so many different styles of poetry. What is it about poetry that so enamors you and intrigues you?
I love the fact, especially with the English language. I mean, I don't know other languages to the degree that I know the English language, but in the English language, you can have 40 different words or more for one meaning. So, you know, if I say alone, you could use isolated, you could use cast out. I mean, there's about a billion different words you could use, and each one is like a subtle variation. So the best way to describe my love for poetry is the same as my love for cooking. If you add one spice, it could be a different variation of a spice. Like, there's a difference between paprika that's plain and smoked paprika. But if you add a tiny different ingredient, it changes the overall feeling of the dish and the overall flavor profile of that dish. And what I'm trying to do is to convey something in the most impactful form of truth. If I'm doing descriptive language or just using language to convey a concept, I'm not conveying the energy signature of that concept in as deep a degree. So if I'm trying to convey an experience to someone who has never had an experience, there is no greater platform than poetry to convey that energetic experience.
Is there a particular poet that you like as far as the message, if you will, or maybe the emotion or feeling that you get from their work?
Yeah, actually, my favorite poet is Dylan Thomas, but most people are going to balk at that because Dylan Thomas was absolutely a genius. I mean, he was Tesla-level good at poetry, but his poetry is morbid. His poetry is raw. It is like having your soul ripped in half, and people who understand suffering will understand Dylan Thomas, but he definitely is not a light poet.
Like I said, I know some of the names, but, I think of some of them, and it's like, okay, that's interesting. my genre was more science fiction, that kind of thing. And then, of course, in the 80s and 90s, self-help and what have you. Mm-hmm. But obviously, I'm noticing that there are more people who are becoming interested in poetry in particular. And again, as I mentioned, there are so many, I'm aware enough that there are so many different styles and ways of expressing. And then when I do think about it very seriously, I'm thinking, well, now, wait a minute, you may not know poetry, but you do listen to music with lyrics. And a lot of times it's poems that have been put to music.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
How about your poems? Have you had a chance to have anybody put them to music?
No, I would love it. I've always thought about that. I don't really possess a flair for figuring out how to create rhythm in conjunction with poetry. Otherwise, I would do it myself. But I would absolutely love it if they were turned into that. I mean, I love poetic music, mm-hmm. for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes you have to listen multiple times and maybe even get a dictionary out to figure out some of the words, the definitions of the words that they're using. Because, you know, I've listened to, for example, one of my favorite artists, John Denver, has used some very poetic language. And sometimes I'm going, what does he mean by that in the context of what I just heard? I that doesn't make mm-hmm. any sense to me. But obviously it did to him. So now I'm going to have to do some research on what he actually meant.
Yeah, there's this guy named Sufjan Stevens, who's kind of like an indie, I don't even know what genre you'd put him in, but he is one of my favorites for poetic music, because like he made a song about a serial killer and a song about, you know, Tonya Harding, the figure skater who was involved in so much scandal. And if you listen to them without the lyrics, you would never in your life or wildest dreams understand that he's talking about what he's talking about. But it is like knowing what he's talking about and going back and listening, it is absolutely amazing.
I also know, too, having made the mistake of getting the wrong words, that it is really important that you have the correct words when listening to the music and poetry, or poetry and music. I have to say, I am so, in a way, I feel a little ashamed at having sung along with this artist so many times on this one particular song. And hey, the last phrase, I think, was along the lines of he'd be no better off if he never saw needless land. Now, those were the words I thought I heard, but it turns out it was actually an eagle fly. And I'm going,
really?
What the heck was I listening to?
What the hell?
Yeah, well, and of course, you know as well as I that over the years, they've actually done these interesting little surveys, whether it's out on the street or what have you, asking people to give them the lyrics to their favorite songs. Mm-hmm. And sometimes what they remember isn't anything close to the song that they were actually singing to and the lyrics that the artist put in there. When it comes to this aspect of loneliness, and in your work, you refer to the pillars, in particular, the pillars, three pillars of loneliness, but you also have in the various parts of your book, you have the pillar of separation, shame, fear, connection, and then, of course, creating connection and then keeping connection. And that's, now, to me, that is an very interesting distinction. One of the things we talk about on this program, of course, is about we have freedom of association with the people that we associate with, regardless of circumstance. But at the same time, and especially considering the description you gave of what you went through, you probably didn't have quite that kind of freedom. I mean, I suppose you could have run away, but where would you have run to? You know?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, imprisonment goes far beyond the way that we normally see it. In fact, you know, I'm very open about talking about the fact that childhood is actually a prison. That's what it is. It's just that your happiness in childhood is dependent upon the benevolence, or let's call it the attunement of your keepers. And some people are lucky that way, and other people are not lucky that way. But a child is being fed full of all kinds of beliefs. I'm stuck in the family house and not just completely at the mercy of, you know, in terms of childhood and in terms of their needs of their parents, right? Because a baby is completely relationally dependent. If it doesn't get fed, it's dying. It can't meet those needs itself. So beyond that phase, even the thoughts that we're fed with act like prison bars. And when that's the only capacity through which a child sees the world, through those limiting often beliefs, then you're being fed by the prison bars that will keep you for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So
I also have to say, too, that and I realize that the individual doing the imprisoning or imprisonment has an agenda, and they're getting whatever it is that they're getting from this process.
Yep.
But I also think, too, that, well, it's like a prison, a federal institution, shall we say. The guards and the warden and all of those people that work there, they're just as much prisoners as the people who are inside, in a manner of speaking.
Exactly.
And I find it interesting that we have these different institutions that continue to perpetuate that concept. I think, too, of the educational institution. I mean, you talked about, you know, childhood. There's an imprisonment. But at the same time, isn't there at least an initial codependence, so to speak, with the child on the adults, especially like, say, mom in particular? Because I know that in spite of the fact that I love my dad a lot, I would say my mother was the one who was the one you always turned to. You know, if there was ever a problem, you went to mom. You didn't go to dad necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, we got to define codependency, because I don't agree with dependence being linked to codependency.
Okay.
And that's where a lot of my teachings differentiate from other people.
Mm-hmm.
Because we like to throw dependency as a concept out the door with the concept of codependency. But actually, dependency has nothing to do with codependency. To depend on something, as long as it has your best interests at heart, there's actually no problem in that. When it starts to become dysfunctional, which is codependency is ultimately a dysfunctional relationship, is when the needs that are being met, or the way that those needs are being met in a relationship, is a detriment to one or both parties involved in the relationship instead of a benefit. It is possible to have dependency be super, super good for somebody. And let's say, I mean, that's going to change based on whatever circumstance. So obviously a baby's completely dependent, but in their dependency on the mother's breast, for example, that doesn't diminish his capacity for personal growth. It doesn't diminish him or keep him back, or is a detriment to him in any way. So the only point at which any form of dependency is harmful is when it is a detriment to a person instead of a benefit. And that's where we need to use our real powers of discernment, because most of us just, you know, throw all of dependency out the window, and we have an addiction to independency.
I know that I've often used this analogy or comparison, if you will, asking the question, okay, under what ism do the cells of our body, the trillions of cells, what ism do they work and live under? Because it ain't democracy. Because if it was, your body would cease to exist, because all the cells would want to do their own thing.
That's cancer.
Well,
that's cancer.
Exactly. So I actually came up with a new term, and maybe this is something we can dive into. And that was interdependentism, if you will.
Yes,
that we're dependent, if you will, and I will go ahead and use that word, on one another, because we are connected. Even if we don't realize it, even if we will not acknowledge that we are connected, doesn't matter. We are. Just like water is wet. You can argue all you want. Water is still wet, no matter how much you argue against it.
Exactly.
So let's talk about these pillars in the construct of this whole aspect of loneliness. And I have to say that when I was a kid growing up, my teenage years, and I was looking for companionship, if you will, I actually did have a girlfriend in high school. And I actually had to go back and apologize to her probably in my 40s, early 50s, because of the way that I treated her. Now, I wasn't abusive, but it was like one of those things where I was not high on the totem pole as far as popularity. And the last thing I needed was to be harassed by those who were at the top of the totem pole. So I would not acknowledge that I had a girlfriend. So when we were at school, I would ignore her. That kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, that not good. And then, of course, I'd go over to her house that evening and we'd spend time together. And it's like this. And I still remember sort of my comeuppance on that in that scenario. After high school, we actually went out on a date. I didn't drive. She didn't have a car. So my mother drove us. Well, the comeuppance was, in a manner of speaking, that at the end of the movie, we were out waiting for them. And who should pull up but a police car? And who should get out of the back seat but my mother? Not because she had been arrested, but because the car had stalled and the police had come and they gave her a ride. I mean, it was like, okay, I guess this isn't going to work out too well. But it's one of those things where you want to belong. You want to be accepted by the group that's around you. You want to be, and I'll use the term, connected. But our society does not facilitate that in in pretty much almost in any way, because they're always looking for ways of, I mean, it's even worse today than it was when I was a kid in the 60s and 70s growing up, where you have, I'm going to call it sort of micro minorityism, if you will, where if you can find a difference between you and every single human being on the planet, you're going to use it instead of finding those things that unite us. But talk to us a little bit about that.
About the fact that society disunites us?
Yeah. And your reflections on this whole aspect of loneliness and being lonely and kind of left out in the cold, as it were.
Well, on just a purely physical level, I actually see human beings as progressing back in the direction of tribe, but it's going to be conscious tribe this time. Unconscious tribe is when you're fed with all kinds of beliefs that limit or that inhibit, and to a detrimental degree, the individuals within the social group. So, of course, breaking free of that was in alignment with our expansion, but human beings have never become more dysfunctional than when we started to separate away from tribe into communities and religions, and then separate away from communities and into, you know, single family homes. And now we're seeing even the breaking up of the single family homes into split and individual homes, where sometimes a child is only growing up in a household with one parent. And this so intensely is impacting our society. It is unbelievable.
Okay.
Because a child way back in...
I just want to clarify. You said that we become more dysfunctional when we leave the tribe. Is that what you said?
Big time.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
So what's happening now is that a child that is raised in today's society, as segregated as it is even on a physical level, that, you know, a child who is raised in a single family home, and more than that, a broken single family home, the problem with this is that they have less access to intimacy. And let's define intimacy for a minute. Intimacy is about seeing into somebody, feeling into somebody, listening to them completely so as to understand them. So it's to be completely received and to completely give ourselves. And that is something which most of us don't do. So it's not just about sex, because when most people hear the word intimacy and hear me saying you need to have deep levels of intimacy with your children, they're like, I'm not going to have sex with my child. That's not what intimacy is. You know, sex can be a byproduct of genuine intimacy, and when that's the case, that sex is usually quite in alignment, meaning it, you know, it's beneficial to both parties involved. But a child who is in one of these segregated situations, broken off from multiple resources, ends up feeling that absence of emotional connection and intimacy, and so their emotional needs are not being met. And what happens when a child has access to more resources is those needs actually get met. So what I mean by resources is that each individual person in a tribe, like let's just think about back in the day when we lived in a tribal setting, regardless of where we are in the world, that is how humans were and naturally are. If I had a son, I could get sick without that son being starved to death emotionally or physically. They would get their needs met. And the emotional needs are far more important than the physical needs, because he could go to an uncle, he could go to a cousin, he could go to, even if he wasn't related to somebody, he could go to another friend. There would be many people who could act as a resource for him in that experience. And it goes far beyond just emotional needs. It also goes towards different ways of coping with the scenario. If you look at a basic tribe, one person in that tribe is going to deal with a situation different than another person's going to deal with it in that tribe. And so a child has access to much more tools for how to resolve a situation for whatever they're going through than a child who doesn't have access to those resources. So right now, as segregated as we've become, even on a physical level, we're making it so the kids don't have access to these resources. And so they have usually only one tool, and let's hope that's a good tool for something. It usually isn't, to deal with their situation that they're going through. And so we're seeing addictions on the rise, because addictions is a tool. It's a tool for coping with emotion. It's not a good one, but when they don't have access to other ways of dealing with something, no other resources, then they would go to that tool, and that's how they would cope. And so we're seeing a serious decline in children today, in our youth. And obviously that translates, because we're not getting our emotions, you know, our emotional needs met. It's translating to individuals who are growing up with no idea how to create intimacy, no idea how to meet their emotional needs, and so they're basically starving. And when we're starving, we start to become manipulative, because we can't feel like, we don't know what those needs are consciously, and yet we need them, and we also don't know how to get them directly. And so our being goes for it in an indirect way, which is the definition of manipulation. It's, I can't go for a need directly, so I have to go for it indirectly. And that never goes well, you know?
Our social definition of intimacy also has expectations that it's going to go in a particular direction. And as you just said, you know, most people, I would say here in the West in particular, when they hear the word, just hear the word intimacy, their mind goes to sex, sexual relationships or something of that nature. And so there are those in our society also who avoid intimacy.
Yes. Well, the avoidance of intimacy is really about pain involving intimacy. None of us are born intimacy avoidant. That only happens when we learn that our connection with other people harms us in some way. And the primary way that it, quote unquote, harms us is when we're in a relationship with somebody in our early childhood, especially, whom being in relationship with them means we have to lose ourselves. So it's what you were talking about, the codependency. Mm-hmm. Codependency is basically, I'm going to give myself up, my personal desires, my feelings, my own thoughts, so as to align with you. So it is a loss of self. And what it feels like on an emotional level is like you're getting swallowed to death. And aside from that, even just south of that, is this feeling that you, it's basically like, not only are you getting swallowed by somebody, because you're losing your identity, there's this constant tension of not being able to be authentic. It's like you're watching every move that you're making so as to avoid a consequence.
Walking on eggshells, yeah.
Yeah, so that tension obviously makes people want to go towards animals or go towards just being by themselves.
Yeah. And again, you're saying that that is, as a, it's a choice rather than the preference. We would prefer to connect, but
yes,
we have been so abused, misused, our trust has been violated in so many different ways. Go ahead.
Yeah, because of lack of intimacy. Now, let's just play this game. If I have intimacy with you, meaning I see you, I feel you, I hear you, and I understand you, it is impossible for me to be that connected without also understanding intimately your best interests. If I'm genuinely connected to you, your best interests become part of my best interests. I can now no longer take an action that is detrimental to you without also hurting myself. So intimacy is actually the greatest safety mechanism we have on the planet. Now, when that's the case, when your best interests are now part of my best interest, I will not harm you. And not only that, you get to keep yourself. And what self is my thoughts, my feelings, my desires, my best interests. You can keep those and be in relationship with me. Where we start to get into pain is where we can't have that. So what I'm basically saying is that the level of loneliness we have and suffering in relationships that we have boils down to one concept. It's that I can't have me and have you too at the same time. So to break out of this, what we have to be willing to do is to go into that space of seeing each other, feeling each other, hearing each other, understanding each other to such an extreme level that our best interests become a part of each other's best interests. And when this is the case, we will not propagate pain in relationship.
And of course, the real irony is that we can be lonely in relationship, because of all that you just described.
Oh, it's the world. Oh, okay.
Well,
I'm so passionate about this because it is the problem.
Yeah.
Like, it is so much worse to be in a relationship where you're in two different perceptual realities than it is to be completely by yourself. So, you know, I'm putting that forth. Some of the worst loneliness you can possibly experience on the planet is in a relationship where someone doesn't feel you, doesn't see you, doesn't try to understand you. You're basically in a room in a different reality than the other person. It's horrific. It's worse than being by yourself because it's like there's a pane of glass. That's the best way to describe it. When you're suffering this kind of loneliness, which is the kind of loneliness that I wanted to solve with this content in this book, it's almost like you're stuck inside a room with a glass divider between you and the other person in that room. And you can hear out, you can see out, but they can't see in or hear you. It is torture.
Yeah. I've even heard of situations in relationships where, as you and you described this quite well, the analogy that I think of is where one of the partners wants to share. They've been asked, so tell me, you know, what happened over there in that situation, blah, blah, blah. And the other person, the other partner starts to share their feelings. And a lot of times it's the guy who manages to muster up the courage to share their feelings and shares, well, I was feeling this because and that. And all of the sudden the other person says, oh, yeah, I know what you mean. I felt like that when I was over here. Instead of staying with the partner and what they just asked them, what happened over there and how did you feel? And all of the sudden they're saying, oh, yeah, that happened to me and I felt this. And so the second partner basically starts to learn that it doesn't do any good to share how I'm really feeling because this person doesn't really care because it's always going back to them.
Yeah. Well, it's ironic because what that person is desperately trying for is for themselves to feel understood as well. So that type of a reaction is the demonstration or a perfect example of how desperate we are to be seen. Some of us are so desperate to be seen by other people that we do literally make it all about us and trying to get ourselves be seen to the detriment of seeing other people. So we basically fail to see that to see somebody else, you are also losing your isolation.
And what's interesting about that is that this person, the second person who was asked the question, begins to develop and start put up the walls or the shield or the glass. And it's not that they are afraid of sharing how they're feeling, because they don't have they would like to be able to do that so that the partner would be there to support them and or encourage them or what have you. I hear what you're saying. You were feeling this way and that way and the other. But it's that they're not being acknowledged for that, and so they figure, what's the point? And so I'm not gonna share anymore. When they ask, I say, oh, I'm okay, doing good. Yeah, life is good. You know, a little upset a little while ago, but I'm okay now. I mean, my wife and I just went through a process of putting down my dog, Makushla. And yet the process of getting to that moment took 14 months. And I say that because she was 16 and a half when we let her go. As my wife likes to say, we released her. And those 14 months were spent caring for her. Now, she was a caregiver all her life. And so now it was kind of like, okay, we're going to care for you, because she had raised several other dogs in the family over the course of those 16 years. And so it was a bit of a challenge. But when we got to that moment, my mind went somewhere. I don't know why it went there. It just did. And she asked me, so what are you thinking? Because she could tell that my mind shifted a little bit from the present moment. So I shared it with her. And she says, okay, I need you to be present, you know. And I got what she meant by that, and I certainly did need to be present in that moment with Makushla and she and the other animals who were gathering around. That was amazing to me. The other animals started to gather around us. In any event, that sort of kind of in a way started to make me feel like, okay, well, I'm not going to go there anymore. I'll just keep that one to myself and I'll just ponder that.
Okay,
but at the same time, she had a valid point, because here we were in this very intense experience, you know, and so forth. So I think individuals have to learn how to sort of, what's the word I want? You need to sort of evaluate where that kind of comment is coming from and also where you are in the moment. And in that case, I think that was probably a relatively appropriate comment to make on her part, because I was sort of, I don't know why I was, it just, you know, our minds, the monkey mind does what the monkey mind does, right? So anyway, it was, and of course we then continued on and I stayed focused for the rest of the afternoon and evening. And we went through it, but I think that's one of the things that I know people are challenged by is the kind of I'm going to call it commentary, you know, that comes up when that question of how are you feeling comes up, and guys are are the worst at it, probably because they're really not given the opportunity. But what I'm noticing in our society today, though, I'm talking here we are in 2018, 2019, is women are going into that same phase because of what's going on locally, statewide, nationally, if not internationally, as far as this whole unbelievable dynamic that's just tearing us apart, not just as far as the tribes, as you talked about, but even as the sexes, male and female.
Yeah, I talk about this all the time. We're in the phase of so much confusion because we are still completely indoctrinated with the traditional roles of what society wants men and women to be and what women, men and women have been for thousands of years. On top of, we have our own predispositions, which just arise out of being born into the energy of female or male, and that's very authentic to us versus the potentially inauthentic programming that we receive from what society wants men or women to be. And then on top of that, we have the fact that we're making a move in society right now to break away from that programming, and now we don't have an idea of what it's being replaced with. So both genders are in a state of complete confusion. You've got men, for example, let's just do men because that's super interesting. Mm-hmm. You've got men who you've still been indoctrinated with the way that men are supposed to be. So just for one example, men are not supposed to have extreme emotions, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you watch a little boy getting raised, they're still indoctrinated with the fact where it's like, well, if they get upset or if they show vulnerability, especially things like fear, it's a toughen up and stand up because you're a man type of philosophy. Yet at the same time, now they're coming into this time-space millennial generation where it's like, no, it's right for men to feel and you need to express your emotions. But we women, we have been also programmed with the idea that because of the traditional male roles, we need a protector. And so when a man goes into a vulnerable role, we don't even know how to hold space for that. So we're watching this like soup of confusion happen within between the genders and within our own desire to move into an authentic expression of that. I actually did a video last week on this where what I noticed within all women was the split between a part of them that wants the traditional female type of an experience, wants doors to be open for her, wants to be able to be in flow, wants to not have to provide, you know, that type of thing. And then the opposite, which is, I don't want to be limited by what you've told me that a woman is. I want to be able to be recognized for the excellence of my craft. And I'm being told that the only way to do that is to be more like a man, which makes my body rigid, which makes me not as open, you know, which creates all kinds of physical issues for me as a female. So I was recognizing the split within women, and I actually put myself out there and worked with this consciousness split within myself. But I mean, you're so right that this isolation doesn't just offer itself up at a societal level, but also in terms of both genders.
I mean, honestly, back in the 80s, I first got into this business back in 1979. And it was in the early 80s, of course, when I was working for a fundamentalist Christian radio station. By the way, I was declared a casualty because I didn't toe the party line when I left 15 years later. And there's an interesting irony. I stayed there for 15 years, but it was the best education I was ever paid for because I learned so much. But one of the things that I found so disheartening, and this was during one of my many phases as I worked through those 15 years philosophically, you know, spiritually and so forth. When AIDS came on the scene, my first thought was, oh, this is just another way of dividing us. This, you know, granted, there may have been a legit, you know, and I'm not saying there is or isn't. I'm just saying that this, you know, whether or not there is or isn't a disease, people have this mentality, this mindset that, and so we've got to separate the population. We got to get those people away. Yep. And I thought, this is just another way to divide. And then, of course, every time we come up to one of those moments of separation, it's, oh, there's another one. And well, here we are again, only now, you know, it's not from philosophical, it's now gender. You know, I mean, women are afraid to begin with because of the I'm not even sure how to phrase this, the pseudo-hierarchical behavior of men in all walks of life. All right. But I'm going to tell you right now, guys are walking around just as scared now, not of being abused, but of the potential if you just look the wrong way.
Yep.
you.
Exactly.
Because here's the problem, with especially with what happened earlier in this month with all the hearings back in Washington. It didn't matter which way that went. We were all in trouble. If he is confirmed, which he was, then it seems like every woman who has ever been abused, or person for that matter, now they're going to be their veracity is going to be questioned, because obviously it wasn't believed in this case. If this guy isn't confirmed, then the guys are all in trouble, because you are guilty until proven innocent. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the really bad situation we find ourselves in this country in particular.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, women right now are in a phase. It's typical when you see anybody break free of any kind of abuse. And to be honest with you, women have been abused for thousands of years.
Yes.
There tends to be a swinging of the pendulum where it's almost like you go completely against whatever your oppositional force is.
Yeah.
And it becomes like a hypersensitivity instead of including the abuser in as part of yourself, which is where women are going to be headed. But I completely recognize exactly what you're saying, and it has bothered me immensely.
Oh, and I shared this in an interview about 3 months ago, and the woman I was interviewing, and we were talking about this, and she actually, the way she said it, there was a little attitude in her response to me. She says, "Well, welcome to the club." And I thought, whoa. Easy.
well, I feel like that,
but
too,
I understand.
I get in trouble with feminists.
You know,
I get in deep trouble with feminists all the time based on, you know, my stance, for example, on drunken rapes. I have a very controversial stance on that, especially for a female. So
I understand. Yeah, and that's and again, I'm sitting here going, okay, how far can I go with this conversation without getting myself into trouble? And of course, you know, when I come at it talking about this subject from the male perspective, I grew up with 5 women in the family, mother and 4 sisters, and it was my brother and me and my dad. So we were in the minority as far as the gender was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But we all worked to get along. So, you know, we made it through. We all survived, and we've all gone on to raise kids and do this and that and the other thing. We're going to continue this conversation here. Stay with us here on Tell Me Your Story. We're talking with Teal Swan. That is the website, by the way, TEALSWAN.com. The Anatomy of Loneliness, How to Find Your Way Back to Connection. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Teal, and we both will be right back.
Tell me your stories.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're talking about loneliness, the anatomy thereof, and we're going to talk more with Teal Swan, the author of this book and many others. She's also written Shadows Before Dawn. She's got The Sculptor in the Sky. I like that title. Completion Process, as well as what we've been talking about, both the disconnection, but also the connection process, which is a spiritual technique to master the art of relationship. You also have on your website, and I have to say, I was just looking at this, you have frequency paintings. Which I was looking at one in particular, and I'm trying to bring it up and find the name. I think this is a meditation aid. Oh, yeah, that's the one. I like that one. That's very colorful. Oh, that's very cool. But you have many others, other popular paintings. Arcturian Calming Grid. I like that one. That's very nice, too. Yes. All of these are very, very cool. And of course, they're available at tealswan.com. TEALWS. No, try that one again. TEALSWAN. And but you've got not only books, you've got the paintings. You have so many other wonderful things that are available on your website. And I encourage people to go there and not only take a look at your the shop that you have available, the gift shop, online gift shop, so to speak. But also the books, as well as the information. And people can touch base with you as well on your website and connect with you to get help if they can, or you can guide them to where they can get sufficient support and help in that regard to get through. You also have what I like, too, the Teal Swan Meditations. Stress relief. We can use that one. As well as light healing and one of my favorites was spirit animal meditation. So you've got some really good stuff available at your website, and we're glad that you're with us here on the program today. We started out talking about poetry. We drifted into a connection, and I was also wanting to touch base in terms of the aspect of the aspect of loneliness, and which is caused by, I think maybe you started to describe this a little earlier, by sort of parallel realities. We're living in more than, and in some cases, it's more than just two worlds that we're trying to live in.
You want me to talk about parallel
realities? Please, yes.
I wish that people understood this concept, because parallel perceptual realities are the most dangerous thing that I see on the planet today. It's when everybody's experienced this to some degree. You go through something together and both of you have completely different perspectives about what happened in that same scenario, regardless of the actual facts. So we are experiencing the world through our subjective perspective, and that opens the door wide for a limitation of knowing what the truth ultimately is, which is usually a view that takes in both polarities. So to understand parallel perceptual realities, let's step into the world of a child, because this just perpetuates into adulthood. The example that I like to give the best is that, let's say that you've got a kid who's a first child in the family, and they spend 1 or 2 years with mom or dad. And what people don't get about that experience is that mom or dad is actually perceived to be the partner. So the child is the same emotional state towards the mom that you would have with a wife or a husband. That's your partner in life, and that's where you go to for your emotional needs, your physical needs. It is that level of closeness. And so when mom comes home and says, you know what, we're about to have another baby, and you're going to have to be patient about the fact that this is a new relationship with this baby because they're brand new and they've got all these needs, so we're going to have to spend a little bit more time focused on this baby. And now suddenly you get pushed to the periphery. That emotional experience is completely different for the child than it is for the adult. For the adult, this is normal. You're getting a new sibling. In fact, I'm creating a playmate for you. You should be excited about it. That's the perceptual reality of the adult. If you were to step into the perspective of this 2-year-old child, it is no different emotional experience than if your wife walked through the door today and said, you know what? I fall in love with somebody else, and this man's going to live with us now, and you really should open your heart to love him, but just so you know, it's a new relationship, and so I'm probably going to be focused a little bit more on him in the beginning, but you'll be excited because you have more, you know, somebody else to love. And then when you react back and you say, this isn't okay for me, you're shamed for that reaction. That is the degree of pain that a 2-year-old who is introduced in an improper or normal, shall I say, way to a new sibling experiences that scenario. And so what we're seeing here is two different perceptual realities, a perceptual reality of the parent that looks nothing like the perceptual reality of the child. And it's our incapacity to perceive that parallel reality that that child is in that makes it so that we can't work that child out of their perception and into a perception where the meaning added to the experience would cause a benefit instead of a detriment to their personal life experience.
Well, and as you say, we take that from childhood into adulthood. And there is an aspect of childhood that I find fascinating that I wish we could take into adulthood, but we don't because it's the other that we take. And that is with a child. You watch kids playing out on the playground or in a park, and everything's going along fine. And all of a sudden, he's racing across the park, trips, falls, and starts to cry.
Yeah.
You leave that kid alone. And what's going to happen most likely within 30 seconds, if not less, is the kid is going to be distracted by something, stop crying, and go to that distraction. Let go of the pain. Okay, I'm okay. No big deal. That's interesting. A butterfly. Let's just say it's a butterfly. Butterfly. And they go following the butterfly. They're still in the park. They're safe and so forth. They stop crying. They don't hurt anymore. They let it go. They don't carry it with them. Oh, I'll cry more later today about my hurt knee. Okay, but I'm going to go chase the butterfly. No, they don't do that. It's gone. But we hold on and hold on as adults. We learn how to hold on to this stuff, which, again, it kind of goes to something James Redfield said in the Stillestine Prophecy, where he talks about how we have messages for one another. But, and I use the word, we put up our shields. I'll use your example of the glass. It doesn't have to be a primary relationship. It can be secondary, tertiary, etc. And so not only do we not share the message we might have for someone else, we deny ourselves messages from others so that we can continue the process of, as I like to put it, putting together the puzzle pieces of the big picture of our lives and understanding who we are and so forth. And I find that I'm curious as to your perspective on that aspect of holding on to pain, holding on to, and again, not disrespecting what you went through, but have you been able to some level, let go of, like a child would a skinned knee, the pain you suffered as a child?
Yes, but can I provide a different...
please. Absolutely.
Okay. All right, let's go back to the scenario with the child in the playground. Part of what you're watching and thinking is a good thing is actually why we can't let go as adults. So let's say that the child falls and they skin their knee and there's no one around. That child doesn't actually know how to work themselves through the emotional state. They don't actually know how to self-soothe. They learn how to self-soothe by being soothed by somebody else. So the way that they cope and the reason that they get up and go chase the butterflies, because they actually have created a split in their consciousness between the aspect who feels vulnerable in that situation and feels hurt, and then aspect that has to cope with it quickly. And so it actually, a fragmentation at that moment occurs, and that experience has never actually been resolved. And when we get into our adulthood, we never learn the capacity to resolve it. We just learn the capacity to cut off from it. But it catches up with us, because what we suppress, we always suppress the aspect that we've cut off from. Whatever we suppress and don't resolve eventually builds up and comes back to haunt us. And so it basically doesn't let go of us. Our capacity to cope away from it, or to split off in terms of our consciousness into a coping aspect, no longer can compensate for the level of suppression that we have on the things that we have not resolved. So I have like a completely different perspective on that experience that you gave. Mm-hmm. Of the child falling in the playground.
Okay.
So what the way that a person in adulthood, for example, the way that they get out of that thing you're very accurately witnessing, which is that holding on to pain, is that you have to teach them what you should have taught them at 2 years old, which is how to resolve pain. So what to tell themselves and what to do instead and what meaning to assign to the experience and how to feel their emotions without rejecting, denying, or disowning them, so that split never occurs. And that's what adults are now in the process of having to learn. And most of the adults I meet have no idea how to do that. The minute we feel an emotion, we turn against it. And so the emotion, whatever you turn against, we persist, actually. So we actually intensify the emotion. And by doing that, and when the emotion intensifies, we don't know how to cope around it. And so we get into some sort of a coping behavior, things like addictions, things like distractions, all kinds of behaviors to deal with that emotion that we cannot let go through us, so that we can see the emotional truth that is underneath that sensation that we call an emotion in our body. And based on that truth, make accurate changes to our life that make us step into a space of in alignment.
Hmm. Interesting. I like that. I mean, I understand what you're saying, and it makes perfect sense. I find it interesting too, that, I myself have been through a number, and this was back in the 80s and 90s. I went through a number of personal growth and development programs, both solo in my early 20s and then with my first wife. And I remember going with her. Now, she was totally blind, but she wanted to attend this program. Well, she needed somebody, obviously, to, you know, guide her through. So I said, sure, I'm your husband. Fine. I'm not doing anything else, honestly. And I found myself in the program. I found myself participating. No, I'm sorry. I'm her guide dog, okay? Just leave me alone. Just leave me out of this. It doesn't work that way. And I think one of the things that I found fascinating, and one of the phrases that they used, and I had to really look at that when they said it, in spite of what I thought were my reasons for being there, they said, you are here because you want to be here. Now, most people were pretty darn uncomfortable, and they really felt like they didn't want to be there. And they went on, they said, and if you wanted to be somewhere else, you would be there. So you must want to be here because here is where you are. And so I sometimes think about that in terms of some of these experiences that we have as adults. The experiences with children, that's different, you know, because you don't have, you do not have that flight or fight aspect quite honed down. And yet, even as adults, we find it difficult to run. I mean, you hear about, and we talked earlier about the women who are just now coming out after 10, 15, 20, 30 years. You know, and I'm sorry, I don't care what some people say. Well, why didn't she do this back when, you know, it happened? You obviously haven't experienced the kind of trauma that she's experienced, and the fear and the intimidation and the harassment and so forth and the threats. So you don't understand. And personally, I probably don't fully understand, but I'm sure as heck not going to sit here and pass judgment and say, look, you should have done that back then and not waited until now. Because it's, you know, this, it, you know, it, it is what it is. And so here we are today, and we're facing these challenges in our society. In terms of your personal story, how long did it take for you to finally be able to come out and say, hey, this happened to me. It was wrong. I was hurt. I was abused. I was imprisoned. I was tortured, et cetera, et cetera. How long did that take for you to finally be able to say that out loud?
3 years after I escaped. But by that point, when I escaped, I was 19 years old. So it wasn't until I was 22, and I was actually forced into it.
Mm-hmm. You were forced to confront it and speak it?
Yeah, I was, because when you go and you see the kind of abuse that I went through is not the normal kind of abuse that people go through. It's not like I was talking about, you know, my dad just hurt me when I was little. Mm-hmm. What I was talking about was murders, because part of the cult groups that this man who I caught the radar of when I was younger were participating in was sacrifice. So wow. We're talking murder. And there's a bunch of regulations that psychologists are enforced into. Like if you threaten that you're going to kill yourself and it's a valid threat, or if you threaten, you know, if there's talk of somebody else getting killed or being killed, you legally have to go to the authorities. So I was put in a position when I thought that I was going to a real safe space, where she looked at me one day, my therapist, and said, listen, either you have to report this or I have to report that. So I sat with myself and was like, well, great. Either I let this woman do it or I do it. And I chose to do it because I'm all about free will. So I went forward, actually, not because I wanted to prosecute. This is the thing, like, my perspective on this planet is not one that most people are going to relate to. I am the kind of person who can take in the perspective, the exact perspective of the very person who's on the opposite side of the knife. There is no part of me that doesn't recognize that the man who abused me was abused in his childhood. I don't want him sitting in a jail cell. I don't want him punished. So until I can create some kind of a system that can rehabilitate an individual whose suffering leads to the suffering of others, I have no interest in that man sitting in a jail cell. I don't want him abusing other kids, but I don't think torturing him for the rest of his life is the way to go about this. So I was not happy about going forward and having to talk about this kind of stuff. But I was also terrified for my own safety. So when I went forward to the police and involved them in everything that went on, it was actually because I was pushed into it.
Hmm. Yeah, that's that's got to be a frustrating situation, because you think, okay, this isn't a problem. This is all confidential. It won't be said to anybody. And you didn't know at the time that if I say this, then it's going to come out.
Yeah, I definitely did not know that. And it made for a very unsafe position. And I'm not the only one that's in this position. I mean, let's just talk about pedophiles for a minute.
Yeah.
I don't want a pedophile to get to a child any more than the next person does. And if I'm in a position where I feel like a pedophile's actually going to act out, and by the way, the majority of pedophiles never act out. If I'm in a position where somebody comes to me, say in this line of work, which has happened several times, and they start to talk to me about the feelings that they have towards children, if I immediately report them, they will never come forward. And actually, the potential for them to act out is much, much higher. So it's really important for some, you know, people who are obviously therapists and who are licensed through state organizations are limited in that way in terms of they are forced, and if they want to keep their license, to report some of these things. But I feel like it's really important for some people to not adhere to that licensing so that they can actually create resolution in some individuals who are actually wanting help with these very real conditions, as opposed to, you know, just getting thrown into a box and punished for it. They're never going to come forward.
You also have some extraordinary gifts. I'm curious as to when you were aware of these gifts. Share with our audience what they are, but also when you became aware that you had them and how you use them today to help people through these kinds of situations.
I was born with these abilities, but they're actually disabilities. That's one thing that people don't understand. Because most of us, when we see psychic gifts, we think of them as gifts, so as extra abilities. But it actually works the other way around with someone like me. When I came into this physical reality, the portion of my nervous system that is designed specifically to hook you into third dimensional reality was disabled. So if you imagine the world that we're living in like a big video game, but you and your individual identity that you call by your name is an avatar within that video game. Most people have a mechanism within their nervous system that enables them to completely hook into that computer game. So the avatar forgets the player sitting on the couch. Because mine was disabled, there's a blending of these different realities. I can't fully phase with the 3D reality. And let me tell you, that creates a hell of a lot of pain in the physical dimension. So it's not like, oh, this is so amazing. It's actually been hell living here on the planet with this disability. But it also means, just like most disabilities actually just open you up to a different realm of possibilities. We know that with people who are deaf. Obviously, when people who are deaf have to overcompensate with their other senses, and so they actually have much heightened sense of perception through their other senses than other people. And this is how I'm working. So it just so happened that this disability that I have meant that I could see a lot of things other people don't see. So when I was born into a family that was super scientific. They didn't have any understanding of what this, you know, other spiritual stuff was. So I was the kid who was talking about what colors people's auras were. I didn't call them auras, but I said, that woman's totally yellow, you know, and I'd be going up to people and to my mother, what it would seem like in midair, I'd be moving my hands through areas of their auric field where there were holes or else accumulations of energy to try to move it around because I could tell that it was unhealthy. And so, you know, if you're watching your little kid talk about somebody being all yellow and then like move their hand around in the air around somebody, you're going, what is going on with this kid? Mm-hmm. You know, and I was scaring, mm-hmm. I was scaring the crap out of people is what was happening. So, I mean, at that point, I didn't know that I saw any different or perceived any different to other people. It wasn't until I started to get into school where I was around other children and really sort of more embedded in society. So around more people than just my parents that I realized that it's like a real problem, you know, because, you know, I remember the scenario where my mom remembers the scenario real well, where I went up to my kindergarten teacher because her dead father was talking to me and wanted to have this communication conveyed to his daughter, who was the teacher of the class. So I went up and started talking to her about what her dead father was saying. Of course, you know, she goes ash white and is like, what is going on? You know? So it was the reactions of other people that started to get me to realize this wasn't, you know, this was not normal. But you know, the real unfortunate part is, if I had been born somewhere like China, they would know how to deal with this. They would, I would have been, you know, not taken away from the family, but I would be separated from them in a way where I had access to people who could guide me in these abilities and guide me through the world with these abilities, which makes living quite hard. I would be recognized for these gifts. They would be seen as a gift instead of a curse. But because I was born in the wrong type of society for that, these abilities, quote unquote, of mine were actually seen as a complete curse. Like, you know, parents, I was treated like I was completely mentally ill. People were scared to death because, you know, when I'm telling somebody that there's some, like an issue with their prostate and they go to the doctor and they find out actually they have undiagnosed cancer in their prostate, they're looking at me not with, oh my gosh, this is an amazing gift. They're looking at me like, this is terrifying. You know, now people are walking in front of me feeling like they're naked all day long. And so there was this, I mean, it still is that way today. I mean, the people who come near me with this complete terror. It's like, I want to go there because I want to know the truth, but I'm scared to death of Teal. So my self-concept was absolutely terrible based on that. And actually all the abuse happened because of that. because the mainstream demographic in the town that I grew up in, which was primarily Mormon, they believe in these types of gifts that I have, but they call them the gifts of priesthood, which can only belong to men.
Ah.
If it's a gift of a woman, it's a gift of the devil. So they literally, I was seen as a sign of what they call the second coming. And I cannot tell you how bad I was treated based off of that. But to the opposite degree, you've got these people in the very same town that believe that they can use these abilities because of that to access the underworld. So that was why this man procured me into the cult groups that he belonged in and basically took me as his own.
Wow. It conjures brings up in my mind, and I've shared this on the program before about the one in the Gospels talking about following the resurrection, the first human being to see the Christ in human form and recognize who he was a woman. Was a woman. Now, from the standpoint of the patriarchal society and the hierarchy wanting to maintain a certain level of control, they screwed up. They should have never allowed that to be in the book, because to me, it also showed the utter blindness on the part of the disciples, who didn't know who the heck he was, thought he was just another fisherman or somebody else. And, you know, hey, have you seen Jesus? He said he was going to raise from the dead. Well, let me tell you who I am, you know, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I even say where Mary Magdalene, want to reach out and touch him to kind of just confirm and make the connection. And he said basically no. And I interpreted that as don't touch me yet. The paint's not dry. Okay, just wait. But I always found that fascinating. When I read that, I thought, why don't people talk more about this? You know, it's not necessary to make women superior and men inferior, but doggone it, for the longest time, men have been made superior, and we're neither superior nor inferior. We're equals, and that's the way we should be treated. But again, it's the process that we have been going through for not just 2,000, but maybe 200,000 years. And it's really unfortunate too, as far as the gifts that you have, and you say you call them disabilities, they've been more of a curse, but I would think that you've made peace with that. And obviously because are you able to, how can I put this? I know you can't turn them off, but is there a way for you to, shield yourself or turn the volume of those gifts down a little bit from time to time?
No. I spent years trying. The only answer, most of my action, of course, to try to do that is to resist this aspect of myself. And I realized I was only making everything worse. So the answer with what you've asked is that I've created a life which completely opens the door for these abilities. So my life looks very different than other people. My diet is extremely different to most people. The way that my house is, where my house is located, the type of people that I keep around me, what I do when I travel, everything is different than the majority of people, because I've had to basically decide at a certain point that I cannot make myself function in society and in the world the way that other people can. I've got to create a life around these abilities, and that's when they cease to do as much damage. And not only that, I committed to this life where I'm like, okay, I can't get rid of it, so maybe this is my gift. So, I mean, if I had a 9-to-5 job, it would be a freaking nightmare. I mean, it would be absolutely a disaster. I cannot do what some people on this planet find easy. So by doing the work that I'm doing in the world, I'm using this to capitalize on creating the type of world that I do enjoy.
Mm.
Like, if for example, it's way different. I went into professional sports, by the way. When I first escaped, I wanted to get away from anything spiritual, so I got into the physical. And when I was doing these winter sports, I would be sitting there at the finish line, and I could see, or the starting line, but I could visually see the emotional states that the people were in. And what I mean visually, this is what you were talking about with those frequency paintings. I'm actually able to see pre-manifested reality. So if somebody feels joy, no matter who it is, joy shows up as a certain pattern within their energy field that I'm visually watching. So when I'm watching the actual impact that it has on the opponent, watching how it changes their life paths, that's a very different and much more difficult experience for me than it is for the average athlete. So I got to a point where the only way to live a happy life was to be able to walk over to that person and to have my life be about, oh, look, this is what's happening in your energy field. Let's see if we can shift the way that your perception of this experience is so that you can change not only your energy field, but those life paths that were showing up negative, we can shift them positive now based on awareness. So this is what I'm doing today, literally is the only way that I've found to make this feel good.
Are there others that you are able to, try that one more time. Are there others who you are able to associate with who share similar gifts that you sort of support and encourage one another in this regard? Because I'm sure that if it's this level of difficulty for you, then it must be for others who have these similar gifts.
Yeah, I've never met somebody who's as quote unquote disabled as I am in this capacity. I have met people who have similar disabilities, but it's usually one, not all of them. You know, it's like usually somebody sees life paths, but it's not that they're seeing life paths at the same time as somatically perceiving everything, at the same time as talking to dead entities, at the same time, you know. So, and I'm open to the idea that they exist, but what has really differentiated me from a lot of, you know, other people who have these likewise disabilities is the fact that they are hiding. Like, you will not see these people talking like I'm doing publicly. You're not going to see them traveling for sure. They're not going to set foot in an airplane. The majority of them live a very secluded life in a very specific way, and they don't expose themselves to the experiences that feel so painful to people with this heightened perception.
Now, based upon your description of China and comparison to living in the States, have you ever thought of moving to China where you would be more accepted and supported? Or part of the world.
It's really tempting. It's really tempting, yeah. And I might do that in the future. But I live in the mountains. I live between Costa Rica and sometimes in the United States in a tiny ski town. So I have decided to stay very close to the mountains, and it's really important for me to have kind of a sanctuary where I'm surrounded by the people who can support these types of abilities and also in a place where I have a lot of influence from the natural world. But I also have to be honest, like I would die if I moved into the middle of the wilderness and never had placed myself in these more painful locations for me, because my calling is so intense towards this. I don't, because of my perception, perceive there to be a difference between you and me. I actually perceive you to be a part of me and me to be a part of you. So I'm operating from this place that if there is somebody in the world who's suffering, that's my suffering. I can't watch them deteriorate while I'm over in a corner feeling awesome. So I am so called to waking up the other aspects of myself around the world, so to speak, that I have to be doing this work. If I was isolated and feeling personally comfortable, it would not escape me that I am doing that at the exclusion of the happiness of other parts. And the reality is I do have the answers for them, you know?
Yeah. Well, Teal Swan, I want to thank you so much for being on the program and sharing your story, as well as the work that you're doing through the book, in particular, The Anatomy of Loneliness and How to Find Your Way Back to Connection. This has been extraordinary, and I couldn't encourage you more to continue what you're doing, which I don't have to do that. I know you're going to, because it is, as you say, your calling. But I'm glad that you spent some time with us, and I hope that we can connect with you again on the program and talk more about this, and then maybe go into some other areas. And as a matter of fact, one of my questions would be to you very quickly here: is there anything that we have missed that you really feel impelled, if you will, impelled to share with our audience that maybe we didn't quite get to?
Yeah, I feel like something that's important to share at the end of this video is that it's impossible to get life wrong, because there's no definition of what a right life looks like. And oftentimes when I come on these radio shows and we have the conversations that you know, people like you and I have been having today, it highlights so much of what's wrong and what we do wrong, and it's like wrong, wrong, wrong. And as people, we want to get it so right that we start to get into a tension about the process of living. So what I would put forth to the listeners today is that if there's no definition for what a right life looks like, and so much of it is individual based on your authentic calling, your own authentic thoughts, authentic feelings, and authentic desires, then there doesn't need to be as much pressure on getting it right. And what that also means to the flip side is you can't get it wrong. Any experience that you go through is going to add to your awareness about what you would prefer. And if you go in the direction of that, then everything in your life actually came to bless you. And I don't expect people who are in the painful experience to see that as a blessing in the current moment. That would actually be to turn against the part of yourself that's hurting. But it is my promise that one day you'll see that everything that you're living is actually a part of the perfection of life instead of something you messed up at.
And you used the key word perfection, a biblical passage about being perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. I pondered that for months, and I finally came to the realization it didn't have anything to do with doing things right or wrong. It had to do with just being who you
yes,
are.
Exactly.
Yeah. TL, I want to thank you so much once again for joining us. And should you find yourself maybe here in the Santa Barbara area, we do have mountains here.
I love Santa Barbara. I love Santa Barbara. I actually was looking to move there.
Well, we'd love to have you. And we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation because there is so much more to talk about.
Yes, there is. Thank you for having me on today.
And before we let you go, I want to remind our listeners, TealSwan.com, TealSwan.com. Again, the book is The Anatomy of Loneliness, and I have three final questions for you, quick ones. And they
okay.
are, first and foremost, who is Teal Swan?
Quick questions. Okay. Who is Teal Swan?
You have got plenty of time. Don't worry. I just put those at the end of the program for our guests.
Teal Swan is a very temporary identity that I have assumed based on the fact that in this time-space reality, we are operating and functioning through individual consciousness. But what Teal Swan is an embodied manifestation of oneness. And oneness, ironically, is the ultimate ego of source consciousness itself.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I want what pretty much every spiritual teacher in history has ever wanted, which is the transcendence of suffering. I want us, you know, pain is a part of your life experience. It's a part of contrast. Through pain, which is what is unwanted, we are meant to go in the direction of our desire, which not only causes our own expansion, but the expansion of all of source consciousness, what we call God. But suffering is what happens when we turn against the pain, and it's what keeps us trapped in pain. It's what makes it so that everything is, you know, that's in the positive end of the spectrum of our life experience is inaccessible to us. So I want the transcendence of suffering on this planet.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
My life's purpose. My life's purpose is integration. For thousands of years, the way that we have addressed things in the spiritual field, especially and in the world in general, is that in order to become good, we have to exile bad. And what I am wanting is the opposite of that, which is love. To love is to push something away from yourself. Now, it's the original teaching of Christ. Now, what love is to take all things as part of yourself. It's the reason why Christ, for example, was going into the leper communities and saying, no, they're part of me. So the ultimate act of Christ is to take Lucifer as part of itself. And what I am here to teach is integration, which means everything you have pushed away from yourself, you own as part of yourself. And by the owning of that, you will actually create connection with that aspect of yourself. And so, by virtue of being connected to you, the expressions that that aspect takes are no longer going to be negative. They're going to be something that adds to the overall enhancement or expansion of the totality. So I want good and evil in pure integration.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've been so frustrated over the decades about this whole world of duality, and yet the ancient
yep.
wisdom teachings teach us where we come from, the one, where we're going to, the one. So why have we stopped here for a puff of smoke's existence in duality? Let's just stay in the one. And I actually do believe that's possible. But again, I thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to having you back again.
Thanks for having me. I'd love it.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal and Makushla.